Welcome to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for spending some of your time with us today. And we've got lots for you on the program today. We begin the show by talking about keeping your annuals healthy right through the growing season. And a great guest for you, Lindsay Hendricks, back with us. Lindsay is the horticulture manager at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, and she will also fill us in on what's happening at the garden, including an exhibit from the Washed Ashore Project, something you're going to want to take a look at. It's amazing. So as we start here, are you having problems with your annuals? Do you need a plant suggestion maybe for a container? What other gardening questions do you have? Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Lindsay Hendricks, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me back.
You know, we were originally going to ask you to talk about how you switch out the summer annuals for fall, but you told Jill Nadeau that you don't have to do that anymore. Why not?
Yeah, we used to swap our containers and some of our displays out for mums and other fall annuals, but with, you know, the climate these days, our season has actually been like extended. July, August, September, even parts of October has still been like really warm, and sometimes we haven't been getting a hard frost until like middle to end October. So our annuals, especially like our tropicals, are usually in their prime, their peak, by the time we would be ripping them out. So we kind of decided, why would we want to like destroy our beautiful annual displays and our containers just to put in like a couple little mums that are only going to last for like a week or so. So we try to incorporate now some season long interest into all of our designs and containers. So we will have stuff blooming into fall. So we don't have to spend the time and money to change everything out, because that's a lot of work.
Yeah, that's kind of what I do too. You know, you try and have some kind of fallish type plants in there the whole season. I've got, I don't know how many, 14 or 15 containers.
Wow, around. A lot.
Yeah, it's a lot to take care of. What are some of your favorites at the botanical garden this year?
For like just our general annuals that we have, or
yeah,
ones that can... Okay, well, we have a lot of our big tropical plants that we overwinter every year. We have like a lot of really great cannas that are kind of coming into their own now. We've had a lot of really warm days lately, and you know, been getting quite a bit of rain. So those guys are really taking off. We have some really cool, unique elephant ears throughout the garden. One of Mark's favorite is called Waikiki. It's got a really cool coloration on it, some white and purples. We have a lot of really cool annual plants. You know, it's really hard, Larry, just to pick a couple that are our favorites, because, I mean, a lot of them are, but our horticulture team did a really great job of designing their beds this year, and I love each one for different reasons and all the plants that are in them. So we just encourage everyone to come in and check it out and see what their favorite is.
Do you have some, you know, now you've got these annuals, they're in for a longer period of time. Do you have some tips for making those annuals look good, look better through the year?
Yeah, for sure. Well, you definitely want to make sure your in-ground plants or even containers are getting an inch of water a week, especially for annuals, to keep them kind of going through their life cycle. We used to fertilize our annual display beds weekly, bi-weekly, with like the Miracle-Gro, the little blue packets you put in your water container, but that took a lot of time. So we actually transitioned to fertilizing our annuals with a slow release fertilizer like Osmocoat. So we sprinkle that in around the plants when they're planted, and then every time we water, every time it rains, they get a little bit of nutrition, so they get bigger faster, look great longer. But we've noticed some of ours are still a little behind right now in some areas. So what we did today, this week actually, is we went around with Osmocote again and kind of sprinkled it around some of our plants that were still a little small, to give them a little extra kick in the butt to keep going for the next couple months. But deadheading your annuals and even perennials will help extend their bloom and keep them looking good so they're not trying to produce seed, which usually signals it's time for them to stop, you know, growing. So you can do deadheading, keeping them watered, fertilize them, you know, whichever method works best for you. And just watching out for any plant diseases or insect pests that might be kind of hanging out by your plants and, you know, take care of those accordingly, depending on, you know, what you have going on.
Yeah. How's the season overall shaping up in the Green Bay area? It sounds like you're getting enough rain.
Yeah, we kind of had a slow start to our spring. It was a little wonky, you know, warmed up, and then it got cold again for a while. So some of our stuff kind of slowed down. But I think now everything's pretty close to on schedule of where it typically is. We did, however, notice, as I think a lot of other gardeners did, lost quite a few plants this year because of the winter we had with the lack of snow cover for a while and then those really cold temperatures. So it seemed like a lot of our Mediterranean type plants, lamb's ear, lady's mantle, lavender, a whole bunch of the plants with the silvery foliage, like, just kind of disappeared this winter. So, you know, that's been kind of interesting for us because we've had to fill those gaps with, you know, different plants this year. But, you know, it's just an opportunity to, you know, try something new. But, you know, a couple of us had, like, I had a really awesome lavender patch going around the cottage garden. And, you know, everyone used to love to take pictures of it. In the spring, I was planting some of my annuals. I'm like, where the heck did all that lavender go? Well, it all got killed off by the winter. So I was a little sad about that, but it's okay. We had other plants to go there. So, you know, I think we're pretty much on course. The rain has really helped us to not have to water so much. But we're still working on getting all of our weeds taken care of because, you know, those will grow pretty much no matter what. So,
yeah, that's weeds are a problem. I've had street work done in front of my house. And so between the sidewalk and the street, I had about 20 feet or so of perennials and some annuals in there too, and they were looking really good, and then unbeknownst to me the street people took out all but about 4 feet of them. And I wish they'd let me know in advance. It was just before the 4th of July weekend. I would have spent the weekend, you know, digging a lot of those plants up. But it given that, and then the rest of the plantings on my side of the sidewalk have gotten weedy, and I was spending time last night doing a little weeding, but it's kind of discouraging when something like that happens.
Yeah, for sure. I'd totally be bummed. But as I tell our garden staff and our volunteers, you know, all the weeds is just job security for us. So we will not run out of things to do for our staff or our volunteers. So not that we like to keep weeds around, but we definitely, you know, we'll always have something to, I guess, keep working on.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we've had hot temperatures in our part of the state. They've been all over the state. Any negative impacts that you see as the result of the hot temperatures?
We haven't really noticed a ton yet at the garden. Like some of our, as some of our staff call the drama queen plants that like to wilt as soon as it gives above like 80 degrees just because they're hot. A little bit of that going on, but we haven't seen a ton at the garden, but I know feedback from garden guests and some of our volunteers is, you know, with the warmer heat, even though we've been getting rain, like a lot of trees and even shrubs can start getting stressed out. So we've heard, you know, in the area, there's been a couple trees, maples specifically, that are already starting to turn red just because even though they've been getting rain, but it's, you know, hotter than they would like. So You know, if anyone sees that going on at their home, you know, they can just give those plants when it's really hot, maybe a little extra supplemental water just to keep them a little happier. But, you know, sometimes when Mother Nature does her thing, you know, we can't really do a whole lot about it. We just have to kind of deal with, you know, what's going on. So nothing too crazy yet. You know, our staff, we've been trying to like keep them hydrated, you know, if they need to take extra breaks. If the heat index gives above 95, we try to get everyone inside, you know, just to keep our staff safe. But yeah, I mean, everything, the tropicals and a lot of our annuals are really actually appreciating the heat that we've been having because they're just going crazy growing now. So getting nice and big.
Yeah, the tropicals, I love it. These are the plants that we usually see as houseplants, right?
Yeah, there's what we call tropicals are basically anything that we grow in the garden that is not hardy to Wisconsin or, I mean, Green Bay right now, which I think we're now around like a zone 5. That you would have to dig up for the winter and can store. So we have a lot of canna lilies, different elephant ear types, lots of dahlias, and a whole bunch of other little like summer blooming bulbs that are pretty easy to overwinter in our shop dormant. So those are the ones that really like it really hot and really humid. So they've really been taking off.
Yeah. How do you use them and or position them sort of in the garden to kind of show them off or work well with other plants?
Yeah, so we have a big list that we keep every year, every fall when we, you know, take down the gardens for the year, and we'll list all the different varieties that we have, about how many we have, and then when our horticulture team are designing their annual display beds for the upcoming season, they will look at that list and kind of know what we have and can plan around it. So a lot of those big tropical plants, as we call them, you know, those are going to be your really big thriller plants, the ones that get really big. So you can either use them as the focal point in your display bed or your flower pot, or you can use them to kind of create a screen between two different areas and plant around them, or kind of use them on the sides to kind of like wall in a certain area. So it kind of depends on your overall like theme and, you know, look of the area, but those big tropicals are usually our big like focal points that take a little bit to get going, but by this time in the season they're, you know, in their prime, and, you know, really stealing the show. A lot of cannas, we have a Pretoria one, it's called, it's kind of like a green and gold stripe. We like it because it's like Packer-esque, you know, with the green and gold colors. So that's a really nice one that really has a nice pop of color against pretty much any greenery that we have.
Lindsay Hendricks, our guest today, horticulture manager at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Horticulture, what's the official title now? Is it the Green Bay Horticultural Garden? I've always called it the Green Bay Botanical Garden.
I'm pretty sure it's still the Green Bay Botanical Garden.
Okay.
We just redid our logo, but I don't think we changed our name.
Okay. Anyway, Lindsay's the manager, the horticulture manager of the Green Bay Botanical Garden. She's here to answer your questions as we talk plants with her, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Lindsay Hendricks, the horticulture manager at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Great to have her back. And again, questions for her? I hope you'll join in. How are your plants doing? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email us. Email address, talk@WPR.org. Emily emailed us from Chicago. She has a baby weeping Japanese maple, and she'd like to stake it to encourage it to grow taller before it weeps over. But she's heard that staking trees for too long can cause weak growth and can wound the bark. She's assuming she doesn't have it, leave it tied for several years. It will take to grow a few feet taller. What do you think?
Well, if I, I guess if you have something that's weeping and you want it to be tall, my first inclination would be to buy something that wasn't weeping. But I know sometimes they look cool and you just want to get them like just above the thing that's there in front of. So, I mean, we've done it here at the garden with some of our, I think they're like weeping beech trees that we have that are really cool, like purple color, but we want to get them going a little bit more upright before they really start weeping. So it's definitely fine to stake it. Just be very careful when you're doing so you don't snap branches off, because typically like Japanese maples are very slow growers. But when you are like attaching the tree to the stake, make sure that you're using a material that is, you know, flexible and not going to rub on the bark. So here at the garden, we used to use like old pantyhose or any sort. You can buy a lot of materials on Amazon now that are soft for plants, and tie it tight enough so it's held in the position you want, but not so tight that it's going to constrict the bark right away. But what I would also suggest is checking and moving the whatever sort of bandage or string you're using to attach to stake up your tree. I'm sorry, you know, adjust it along the bark or the stem, main trunk of your tree. I'm sorry. So it's not leaving a mark on the bark. So as long as you're kind of moving it around so the bark isn't growing into whatever you're tying your tree to the stake, you know, that will be okay. And then after a couple years, once it's kind of going the direction you want it to, you can take it off and kind of see what happens. So I do have an apple tree on the side of the cottage garden that's espaliered. So it's, you know, pleached against the side of the building. And I do have some wires wrapped around those branches to hold them in place. But when I'm doing my pruning every winter, I take those wires off and I readjust them onto a different part of the branch. So that way you're not going to girdle the stems that are being attached to those supports. So can definitely be done. Just be careful and make sure to use a flexible material to tie the branch or the main stalk to the stake that you use, and keep an eye on it so it doesn't rub through the bark.
Yeah, all good advice. Let's take a call from Lori in Stevens Point. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Larry. I planted snapdragons in a southern exposure planter that gets lots of sunlight, no shade, and I have fertilized them and staked them up, and they are not doing well. Any suggestions to encourage them? I've pruned them back, and they're bushing out, but I'm not getting any blooms. I don't know if snapdragons are not an appropriate annual to put in a planter, or if the guest has suggestions for an annual or a perennial that would be do better getting all that sun and heat.
Yeah, so the thing about snapdragons and most varieties that are probably out in the nursery industry for, you know, people to buy tend to be more of a cool season loving plant. So they're really great in spring containers, early summer containers when the temperatures are a little bit lower. But once it starts getting hot and humid and the days get longer, that kind of signals to those snapdragons to stop blooming. So they're trying to save up energy. They just don't like it really hot. So what they're probably doing right now is, it sounds like you're doing everything right. You're like watering them, fertilizing them, pruning back, staking them up. I would just be patient with them, because once it starts cooling off, I know here up in Green Bay, the last couple of days have been, the mornings have been like high 50s, and then it eventually warms up, you know, the end of the day. But once the nights start cooling down a bit, that will signal those snapdragons to start producing flower buds again. So if you leave them in, they will probably start blooming again closer to late summer, early fall. There are some varieties of snapdragons that are more heat tolerant. I can't think of the specific examples right now, unfortunately, but if you go online and just, you know, Google heat tolerant snapdragons, I think the we have 20 peach in the 20 series or double shot series. It's an All-America selection winner that we have a couple plants here at the garden, and those have been blooming throughout the summer. So it kind of depends on the variety of snapdragon. Some are more heat tolerant than others, but if you have no shade, lots of sun, southern exposure, I would probably suggest something for next year. You know, like petunias, lantana, those can provide lots of color, but aren't bothered by the heat. Different types of salvia. You know, there's probably a lot of things that would do well, honestly, but the snapdragons I'd probably keep for like a spring container or one that maybe gets a little more shade so they don't get so stressed out.
Good advice again, Lori. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Joe in Wisconsin Dells sent us an email. He has black locust trees in his yard, and they only shade the garden in the late evening, but he's having problems with the roots. 4 inches down, he runs into the thick roots, and then a new sapling appears a few days later. He writes here, I'm kind of quoting him, "Is there anything I can do about these trees that appear to be diamond-coated, spread like mint, and have thorns like razor wire? Or is it just best to change my name and start over in a new town where no one knows me?" Oh, I love that.
Oh, so I'm assuming he's just concerned with it kind of spreading and suckering all over.
Yeah, that's the way it sounds.
Yeah, I mean, we have a couple here at the garden that thankfully haven't gone crazy, but I mean, it is kind of annoying when they send up all those suckers, literally suckers, you know, and then you have to kind of take care of them. So I don't think there's really a whole lot that you can do to prevent that from happening, unfortunately. Like, I know if you're digging around the base of the tree a lot and disturbing the roots, that's just going to encourage them to probably keep suckering because that root's damaged. So it's kind of like, oh, I need to like start growing another tree so I don't die. So you're almost like stimulating it to do it more if you're digging around underneath the tree a lot. So typically when you have a nice big tree, try to avoid digging into the root zone, just not to stress it out more. So or you can just plant a ground cover underneath it that really likes to go and you don't have to do much with. You know, lamium I know can pretty much grow everywhere and anywhere, and you can just let it go and don't have to dig it up much. But then that creates its own problem when it starts spreading to other areas of the garden that you don't want it. So I don't want to tell you to go change your name and, you know, move and all that stuff, but you know, you definitely don't want to like apply any herbicide or anything to those little suckers that come up though, because they're literally attached to your main tree. And if you start applying herbicide to kind of keep them knocked back, you're going to start affecting your tree. And then, you know, it might eventually like go downhill and die. So, yeah, I guess it's probably more of a personal preference, but maybe stop digging around underneath it so much. And then the suckering will hopefully slow down, and then just try to get something underneath it that can just grow and be left alone for a while.
And in case Joe wants to take a saw or a chainsaw to the base of the tree, he's got an area in his yard that is full sun. Well, he gets shade in the late evening. What would be an alternative tree that's something sized like a black locust that might not give him so many problems?
Well, we kind of tend to go towards like the native route of trees just because of the ecological benefit for all the insects and birds. You know, there's a lot of really nice cultivars of maple trees now, you know, that can give you fall color. So I know the locusts, they turn the pretty yellow in the fall, but they have all those little leaves that get all over the place. So, you know, maple leaves aren't as big. You can still get a lot of them, but you can get a lot of different pretty colors. And depending on the size of your yard, you know, there's different varieties that will maybe stay a little bit smaller, not grow so fast. So That would probably be one that I would suggest. There's also a lot of like ornamental, if you want something that has more seasonal interests, like blooms, different crab apples, magnolias that can grow, which shouldn't do a lot as far as like suckering or anything like that either. So I guess it kind of depends if you're looking for something more ornamental with like flowers or just like a nice big tree that's going to give you some color in the fall. So I always push towards native trees or varieties of native trees just because typically don't have to worry about them becoming invasive down the road. And they have a great benefit for wildlife, you know, insects and birds and everything that might use the tree to live.
Makes good sense. I've got an email from Monica. She has many rose plants in her containers this year. She'd like to plant them in her garden before winter. When should she make that move?
Well, if you, I guess if they're just the rose by itself in containers, and you don't have to worry about trying to, you know, take apart a whole annual planter and save the roses, you can pretty much plant them whenever you want. I would, I guess, maybe watch the weather. If we're going to be getting into some more like hot spells yet, I would maybe wait until it cools off a little bit more reliably, because it can be a little bit of a shock to your roses to plant them in the ground, and then it gets really dry and hot. They don't get as much water as they want. But typically, like through August and even into September, you could probably do that. But if you want to give them the best chance of kind of reestablishing themselves in the ground, you know, I would probably do it sooner rather than later. But then also, depending on the variety of roses you have, and I don't know them all by heart because I'm not a rose expert, but I would probably cover them in some mulch for the winter or protect them somehow, because a lot of roses that we grow in Wisconsin aren't always hardy to our winters. So if you don't provide some sort of protection, you know, the crown can die and then your rose won't come back next year. So here at the garden, all of our hybrid tea roses, grandiflora, floribundas that aren't hardy to our winters get mulched in like 2 to 3 feet of mulch for the winter, and then we uncover them in spring. So especially for the first season that those roses are in the ground, I would give them some sort of protection and maybe cage them so the rabbits or voles don't go in there and like girdle them, where they chew the bark off the stems and then your rose dies back anyway. So definitely doable, maybe sooner than later, protect it over winter and make sure it gets sufficient water going into winter before the ground freezes, because then it's less likely to get stressed out and more likely to come back next year.
Lindsay Hendricks, our guest today, horticulture manager at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Great to have her with us. And you can join in as well. We're getting some good questions here. What about you? Question about your plants. Give a call at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Greg emailed to ask when to prune his lilac trees. They're getting a little long in the tooth, but he'd like to try and preserve as many spring blooms as possible.
Ah, that's a good question, because lilacs are one of those trees that blooms on old wood. So typically you do a lot of your winter pruning when things are dormant. But on lilacs, for example, that bloom in spring, you might be removing the blooming wood and then not have it for the next spring. So typically what I like to do or try to do here at the garden is after the lilacs are done blooming, you can see where the spent bloom is. You know, you can deadhead that if you want, but that's actually probably a good time to be doing some of your pruning if you're trying to take back the whole, like the size of your tree in general and like scale it back and make it smaller, like tipping back a little bit. That would be the good time to do that. But if you're looking at taking out like a third or so of the biggest, oldest stems and you want to do more of a rejuvenation prune, that's probably best to do in winter when your plant is dormant, so it doesn't send up a lot of suckers and then you have this big mess the next spring to kind of deal with. So Here at the garden, I kind of do a combination of both. I try to remove spent blooms after it's done blooming and tip things back a little bit, because then your lilac has the whole season to create, you know, new wood, which next year will be considered old wood. So it will set those flower buds, you know, end of summer, early fall. So it might be getting a little late-ish to, you know, do that now. You can try it. Otherwise, I would wait until next spring after the lilac is done blooming, where you can kind of take a little bit more out of it, and you'll see, you know, where your blooms are. You still get to enjoy them in spring, but then it has the rest of the season to kind of grow new wood that will be flowering wood the next year.
Louise in Dodgeville has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I bought a plant this year for the first time for our deck to put in pots, and it's called a popcorn plant, C-A-S-S-I-A, however you pronounce that. So it's really kind of interesting because it like kind of opens its petals in the sun and then it closes its petals in the evening. But I wondered about bringing it indoors for the winter and if it would survive, because I think it's a tropical plant.
Yeah, we actually use the popcorn plant, or like a Senna, Cassia, depending on, you know, your common name and what it's sold as, is a really cool plant. It smells like buttered popcorn, the flowers do. I don't know that we ever overwintered it here in the garden, but it's definitely something that you can try if you want to try growing it again next year and, you know, having a bigger plant that will bloom earlier. So, you know, it's like, looks like it's a zone 9 to 11 plant, so definitely won't, you know, survive our winters. But since they're already in, my suggestion to try, like I said, we haven't done these before, but based off of what we have overwintered successfully, like, since they're already in a pot, you know, before we get a cold snap or a killing frost, I would, you know, pull all the other annuals out that you don't want to keep and then kind of lay off the watering. So it kind of signals, you know, to go dormant. It might drop some of its leaves, not look very happy, but, you know, that's okay. And then as long as you have like either a basement, a nice, cool, dark basement, or like if there's a part in your house that's not going to be like really warm and sunny, you know, you can bring it inside if you have room and just keep it in the pot that it's already in, because then you don't have to disturb that root system. And you can check on it like every couple of weeks, give it a little bit of water if the soil starts drying out, because you basically are like just barely keeping it alive and don't want it to be actively growing. And then in spring, late spring, usually like March, April, you can bring it back outside in your garage so it doesn't get like super cold, but then start watering it and the sunlight will kind of signal for it to start growing again. So that might be the easiest way to do it, especially if it's really big. If you have a lot of supplemental lighting and like a Four Seasons room that's heated where it'll get lots of sun, you could try to keep it growing alive. But my assumption is it will get really big and leggy. I don't know what kind of insect pest it might get, so it might not look very good in the winter. But the easiest way might be just keep it in the pot, bring it inside, lay off the water, kind of let it just hang out for the winter, and then try bringing it back out, bring it back to life in spring and, you know, see what happens. So I would definitely try it and let me know how it goes. So if we ever get those again, we can maybe try saving a couple and have a bigger, cooler plant next year.
Yeah, that sounds great. Louise, give it a shot and let us know how it works out as well. Joe in Ontario, Wisconsin, what's on your mind?
Hey, so I've got a bunch of grapevines that aren't doing very well, and I was wondering about the best way to transplant them, when to transplant them, what I can do to get them to grow and produce. They're upwards of maybe 15 years old, and I've never really gotten any grapes off them. And then I also have some new grapevines that I bought, and I'm wondering what the best type of soil and just, you know, just some any insights that you might have.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that, Larry, do you have any experience growing grapes?
There's a UW Extension publication called Growing Grapes in Wisconsin. And it's a dandy little publication, been around for quite a while. But if you go to the Learning Store, UW Extension Learning Store, and type in Growing Grapes in Wisconsin, or just type in Growing Grapes in Wisconsin, it's probably going to pop up, and you'll get a lot of really good advice on that. If you haven't, you had them 15 years and you haven't done any pruning, for example, the pruning is going to help, could help with your production. It's hort.extension.wisc.edu. Boy, that's a mouthful. hort.extension.wisc.edu, and then type in articles or as well, and it's probably going to pop up, Joe. And I would go to that, because you're getting a lot of really good advice in that publication.
Yeah, I would agree, Larry. That popped up when I was kind of looking too, because I have one grapevine in the cottage and it's usually growing way more than I want it to. So I'm constantly cutting it back, and that's probably why it keeps producing new growth and grapes for me. But if I know one thing, sometimes if, you know, plants are producing fruit or flowers, you know, making sure if it likes full sun, it's getting full sun. If you do decide to transplant them, I would probably wait till like next spring when they're kind of dormant, just start growing, because then they have the whole season to kind of reestablish themselves. But I would definitely check out that article, because it's probably got a lot of really great information in there, depending on your situation at home, you know, to kind of get you growing in the right direction.
There you go, Joe. Thank you very much for calling. Ruth in Chippewa Falls, what's on your mind?
Well, I would like to know why you never hear anything about a basswood tree. Nobody, you don't hear anybody planting a basswood tree, or it's suggested even.
Yeah, basswoods.
Sure.
Ruth's wondering why she doesn't see many basswoods around, or why they're typically not recommended, or at least she hasn't heard of them being recommended.
Okay. Well, I know at the garden, and that's why I'm just checking the common names, because, you know, sometimes common names are very regional and not always that common, depending on where you're at. But, you know, the tilia trees or like the lindens, I don't know why they don't suggest those more. You know, we have a couple like linden trees at the garden, not overly as much, but some people I know can probably think they're a little bit messy because of all the flowers that they have, and they can drop, you know, all those little petals and the seed pods and stuff once they're done. But I know the ones that we have at the garden, if you have Japanese beetles in your areas, they do tend to attract Japanese beetles. And the people that choose to spray for Japanese beetles or treat systemically, the thing with like the tilia family or the basswood family is those trees are typically blooming at the same time as the pollinators are out, the Japanese beetles, the bees and everything. So if you apply a systemic insecticide to that plant, you know, it can affect the pollinators in a negative way. Or if you spray those trees to kill the Japanese beetles, you can also spray, you know, the bees and kill all the good pollinators. So maybe that's why people aren't suggesting it as much, just because of, you know, the invasive pests that really like that tree and having to control it and looking good without, you know, negatively affecting the native wildlife. But I don't know. I think they're kind of a cool tree. They definitely have like fragrance to them when they're blooming. We have a really nice one outside our building that, you know, it smells up the whole parking lot when it's blooming. So,
yeah, there you go, yeah. Ruth. Thank you very much for calling. Lindsay Hendricks, our guest horticulture manager at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk. Our guest, Lindsay Hendricks, horticulture manager at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. It's great to have her back. And I just wanted to mention, coming up, we're going to be talking at the top of the hour about how scammers are using artificial intelligence to catch your eye with unusual and fake plants. That'll be at the top of the hour. Right now, Carrie in Janesville, what's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. And it's funny, you guys were just talking about the linden tree. I have huge linden trees, beautiful, over my front flower garden. And like you said, all the seeds that come down. My first question is, why some years is there so many more seeds than other years? I mean, last year I hardly had any, and then this year my gardens are just covered. And then my second question is, do these seeds hinder the growth in my garden? Should I clean that out?
Well, that I'm sure, because even like apple trees, fruit trees kind of go through the same thing. Related to the carbon nitrogen cycle of the plants, you know, and typically sometimes it can, you know, depend on the environment and how stressed the tree is. Like sometimes trees, if they're really stressed out, will produce a lot of seeds because they think they're going to die and they want to reproduce. You know, so some years they will do it because of that. Other years, you know, the tree was really happy and healthy and just had a lot of energy stores. So then it will produce a lot of seeds. So, but typically if you have a year where any tree is producing a lot of seeds or fruit, you know, the following year is typically going to be like a little bit lighter, because after the tree uses all that energy to produce the fruit or the seeds, you know, it kind of needs to rebuild its energy stores. So, you know, it kind of depends on that carbon nitrogen cycle going on within the plant, but also can be environmentally related to as well, if it's, you know, stressed out or just getting a lot of nutrients and water. But I mean, it is very annoying as a gardener, either here at the garden or at home, you know, when you have these trees that are dropping all these seeds and then you have to clean them up and then you have to, you know, like weed all the seedlings that come out afterwards. So, you know, I don't think they're necessarily gonna like hinder anything in your garden if they start growing. But if you don't want the seedlings to, you know, growing and then have to weed them out later, you know, definitely trying to clean up as they fall, you know, might be the best way. It's a lot of work up front, but then it saves you from having to pull any weed, little weedy seedlings, you know, that come after the fact. So
there you go, Carrie.
Yeah, it's going to harm anything. It's just a little bit more work no matter which way you do it, I guess, unfortunately.
Right about that. Carrie, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Before we run out of time, I did want to mention the exhibit that you have at the garden. It's called Washed Ashore, and it is an amazing exhibit. Talk about it for us. It's something that everybody ought to see.
Oh, yes, for sure. So Washed Ashore, Art to Save the Sea. We have over 9 different sculptures this year. This is actually the second time we've had the display at the garden. We have, I think, 1 or 2 sculptures the same as the first time. Stanley the Sturgeon, he was actually commissioned the first time he came to the Botanical Garden, and he was made from plastic and trash that was collected from the Great Lakes region. So that's pretty cool. He's specific to, you know, the Great Lakes area. But we actually have this exhibit is only here through September 2nd. So we have about a month left. So if anyone wants to come check it out, you know, make sure you get up here. We're open daily now this time of the year. Admission to the exhibit is included with your admission to the garden. So, you know, guests of all ages will enjoy it. Like a lot of kids really enjoy trying to find the different pieces that are in each display. They each have interpretive signage with them that kind of talks a little bit about, you know, what that sculpture was created with and, you know, all the different products that are inside. But, you know, it really helps to spread awareness of, you know, why it's important to keep our waterways clean and safe for all living things, you know, and basically picking up your trash after yourself. So, you know, you got a lot of really great sculptures. They're all really cool and colorful. You know, everyone seems to enjoy them. So we would, you know, come check us out, open daily, you know, and through September 2nd, then they're going to have to go on to their next home for the next couple months.
Yeah, and just the bright colors and the large size. I mean, these are not small.
No, they are. One of the artists came out and he told us, and one of the interesting things is like all the colors of the sculptures are the natural colors of the trash, the plastic that was found. So nothing is painted to look a different color. It's natural color. And I think the eagle is probably one of my favorites. It's just like so huge. You go up to it and all the details of the feathers, like the big jellyfish that's hanging down by the children's garden off the lodge ceiling is like all the way to the ground. So these things are, you know, like larger than life, but we encourage you to get up close to them so you can view all the different pieces that are in there and kind of, you know, look for the different things. And it's really cool to see everything. And we've got to see a lot of the behind the scenes of, you know, how the sculptures were created. So I think we have links to that on our website too, if you want to get more information of like what goes into the sculptures and why they're so cool. But yeah, larger than life for sure. Kids love them. Adults love them. Everybody loves them.
They are absolutely amazing. And I'm glad you've got them on the site. What's your, and just so we don't forget, the Green Bay Botanical Garden website is...
It is, say it with me slowly, gbbg.org. Kind of a tongue twister. It's basically the Green Bay Botanical Garden.org, but gbbg.org.
Two B's in the middle. You start with a yeah. G, two B's in the middle, and a G at the end.
Yes, it's a GB sandwich.
Okay. Oh, man. Carrie sent us an email. What kind of soil should he use for a cactus?
Ooh. Cactus soil. So you can buy different like soils for cacti and succulents, you know, at most nurseries, greenhouses, anywhere that you go. But typically with cacti, you want something that's going to be really quick draining because those cactus live in deserts where they don't have lots of water, so they don't want to be kept really wet. And a lot, if you use an average like potting soil, there's too much peat and other products in there that are going to hold on to the moisture and your roots are going to rot. So I usually just buy like whatever potting mix, cactus succulent potting mix is at the store for the amount that I need. Typically they're in pretty small bags, but you can get them bigger. But I actually like to add a little bit more sand to my mix and sometimes a little bit of perlite too, just to make the pot, make sure it drains really well, but also a little extra perlite, you know, kind of makes the mixture a little bit lighter so it's not so heavy. I do have a couple of cactus at home that I started from seeds many, many, many years ago, and they're huge and heavy as heck. But I've used the same Miracle-Gro cactus potting mix since I've had them. A little bit of extra sand and perlite in there, and they're doing just fine. So my suggestion with those or any succulents is just go light on the water, especially in wintertime when they're more technically kind of dormant and not actively growing. But if you're going to transplant them, I would suggest doing it before you bring them inside, if they're outside right now for the summer, so they can kind of reestablish themselves before going inside or through winter when the light levels go lower and then they kind of slow down a little bit.
I had one in my lake home that was got to be 12 feet tall. It was amazing. Oh, man. On that heavy note, Lindsay, it's always a pleasure. I hope a lot of people come and see the gardens and see that Washed Ashore exhibit. And again, go back to the website, gbbg.org.
Very good.
Thanks, Lindsay. Really appreciate
it. Thank you, Larry. Have a good one.
We'll look forward to your next visit. Lindsay Hendricks is the horticulture manager at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Coming up, we're going to talk about AI and plants. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look now at how the use of artificial intelligence is infiltrating the plant business. Gail Pabst, our guest today, horticulture and marketing director at the National Garden Bureau and All-American Selections. And Gail's with us to talk about this growing problem. And I hope you will join in if you had experience with AI plants or have a question about a plant you're tempted to buy. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Gail Pabst, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Larry. I'm glad to be here.
Before we talk about AI, I want to talk about the National Gardening Bureau. Tell us about the Bureau and what it does.
We're a nonprofit. We're the only nonprofit gardening association. We started in the 1920s by the person who wrote The Victory Garden. And so our job is to give correct facts about gardening and help gardeners be the best that they can be. And all of our members are like breeders and growers and online retailers and just a whole wealth of the horticulture industry is part of the group.
Yeah, long-standing group. And tell us, what are the All-American Selections?
All-America Selection is a nonprofit that trials new and never before seen non-AI plants. And these plants are trialed across North America, and the ones that do the best across the whole times become AAS winners. So if you happen to see AAS winners on your logo or like, you know, on the plant tag or you read about it somewhere, that means it's been trialed and tested and should do really well in your garden as well.
Well, your latest newsletter, which is quite good, by the way, includes a great article on AI plant scams. What do these scammers do? Describe that.
Okay, so, and I don't know if you've, I'm sure if you're on social media, you've seen them. These plants are amazing.
Yeah.
They look like, you can have them look like dragons, or they're monkey faces, or beautiful colors and checkerboard irises and plants that are taller than your house. Just amazing plants that you see as you scroll by and you're like, wow. And they're hoping you'll want one to be the coolest gardener in your area.
So. And so, and those images that you have in that article, which I hope everybody gets a chance to take a look at, the images are absolutely enticing and amazing. Well, you get interested in the photos. What happens after that?
So then, if you will get interested in the photos, and then you read the description, right? And then if it says, they'll hope that you want to buy this plant because it's a rare, exotic, you know, never before seen plant. And then you can purchase it. And then you will either get generic seeds. If you wanted a beautiful begonia, you would get regular begonia seeds or, you know, just run of the mill begonias, or you'll get nothing. And they will leave, of course, with your money. So,
What are the kinds of charges that you've seen for those plants?
You know, that's the part about it that I think they get a lot of people is that they're very inexpensive. We're talking, you know, $5, $10, $20. I mean, not like hundreds of dollars, but I guess if you get enough people, you can make a nice, you know.
Well, yeah, you know, if it's $5 or $10. Somebody's, I'll give that a try.
Exactly.
So you send them the money somehow, sure electronically.
Yes. And I would hope with not your pay, without your bank, with just a, you know, the PayPal or your credit card, something that you can trace back and, you know, and say no when you don't get it.
So these, and you're right that these scams are on the rise. How come?
Oh, yes, because it's easy to make beautiful plants, right? So you can make them look gorgeous, and you can always tell when they're an AI, because not all, because they usually just take a picture, show a picture of one item, like, you know, the close-up of a flower, or everything else in the background might be blurry, because it's easier to do a picture that way, and more exciting than trying to make the whole picture. And it's also always perfect. The plant is always perfect. And you know, as a gardener, no plant is as beautiful as they're showing it, with no darker, you know, spots. And it's always, yes, and it's on the rise just because AI is on the rise. So you'll be seeing more and more of these plants as you go through. And you always want to check. I don't know if that's on your next thing, but if somebody tells you it's a, I don't know, they're going to call it something, you want to look and see, Google that and see if, is this even come up? You know, because a lot of them won't come up as a plant or look like this.
Yeah, it's, I'm telling you, it's terrible that we even have to now stop and stay safe while shopping for plants.
Exactly. Exactly. Isn't that because, you know, there's that glow in the dark petunia, right? There is a glow in the dark petunia. It's true. And if you Googled glow in the dark petunia, they will show you where you can purchase it, who bred it, where it's from. If you Google any of these plants, you will not find anything about them.
So I mean, if you're tempted, that's probably the thing to do.
Yes, research. Go to retailers or online retailers that, like Annie's, that are reputable, and check and see if that plant is even exist. You can also take the photo and put it into Google Photos or one of those reverse.
Yeah.
And they'll tell you if it's a AI.
So if should you comment on fake AI photos?
Yes. No, don't ever comment. Don't ever say, oh, this is AI, because the more comments they get, the higher up they'll be seen from social media. They, you know, they'll show it to a wider audience. They will also, if you comment, you'll be seen, shown more of those. So the best thing to do is ignore, or you could click on the and tell whatever platform you're on that this is AI. Do not comment on it. If you want to comment to your friends and say, look at this, is ridiculous or whatever, or whoever, somebody commented, that's fine. Just don't engage. Is that,
yeah.
How do you say that? Engage, yeah. With the post. That just gives them more fuel.
Yeah. And you know, I'm just thinking about this. If they send you a packet of seeds and then you still say, okay, well, I'm going to grow these plants up, I mean, a fair amount of time is going to go by here.
Yes, exactly. And then all of a sudden you're lost. I mean, and to tell you the truth, I really don't know how much the things cost, but they're not that expensive, like hundreds of dollars. But still, I'd be mad if I was expecting a beautiful begonia and it turned out to be a regular begonia that I could have bought.
By the time, and by that amount, a lot of time has gone by.
Right.
And
those
then
people have left. They have left the building.
And then you either you realize you got scammed, or I must have done something wrong, because this is not.
And that's what we gardeners do. Don't we always blame ourselves?
And then it's, well, it cost me $10. I guess that's a lesson learned, and there you're out the money. And then is there any idea about how many people have been scammed on this, or how?
I think it's just so new. I mean, that I haven't seen any data that said like how much. I do know like Pinterest is now starting to put on AI generated photos, little tag on the bottom that says AI generated. But that is new, and is, I wouldn't believe ones that, oh, it doesn't say that tag, so they must be true, because there's a lot of pins on Pinterest to go through photos to put them all AI generated. And I'm not sure if they just are doing the new ones or, you know.
Well, on a little different matter, every year the National Garden Bureau selects year of the plants, and you select them in six different categories, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, there are six different categories.
Why so many?
Because there's so many plants out there. And we used to start with just a few, and then, you know, it was like, oh, we need to do shrubs because there's so many fun and exciting shrubs out there. And then we added houseplants because, come on, there's a ton of houseplants that are fun and you can talk about. So, yeah, it just kept on growing. And now we have six, and I think that's it. Maybe.
You're never going to say never, but right for
no,
now
I'm
it's.
I'm never going to say that.
For now it's six.
It's always fun.
How are they chosen again?
They're chosen by the breeders, and we have a committee that goes through and looks at what's up and coming for popularity. This year, for the 2027s, we had the public vote. We had all, there's a horticulture convention called Cultivate in Ohio, and we had all the people that attended that could vote. So it was interesting to get a different take on what people thought the next in 2027 should be.
Have you got a list of the current six?
Yes, I do.
Let's talk about what have you got?
Okay, I have. Now I'm going to have to look them up because I forget them. Don't tell anybody. Okay, so the perennial is the year. It's the year of the Asclepias, which is milkweed. And that one's great because, I mean, who doesn't love milkweed? And there's so many different types and varieties, and it's amazing. And, you know, they all grow in different areas, a lot of them. So it was fun. I have to tell you, Diane, the executive director, and I, when we do these year ofs every year, it's like, I have to grow that because you learn so much. You go, that's amazing. So
that's one.
Then we have the bulb, which is the year of it's the caladium, which is a beautiful, who doesn't love caladiums? Great for shade and sun. Our annual is the calendula, which that's a fun plant. Beautiful flowers and great for so many different, people put them in tea and, you know, do a lotion. It's just fun. And the houseplant is the Monstera, which is also. Now I have like four Monsteras in my house because of this. And dogwood. There's so many different dogwoods, you know, all the shrubs, the red twig and the yellow twigs. There's so much you can do in your landscape with dogwoods. And then our edible was pea, which is also very fun for spring and fall.
So now do you have the selection of the kind of peas that are in there? Yeah, go ahead.
You have Shaolin, you have Snap, and there's three. Come on. I'm testing you, what's the third?
I don't know off the top of my head either.
Okay, wait, I can find this.
Because I love peas.
English, Shelling, Snap and snow. Snow peas, duh.
And when are you going to be announcing the latest ones for
2026 is going to be next. This coming, what do I want to say? But if you're really fun, I can tell you. You're not supposed to know until January. But you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. Let's have them.
2026 is the year of the azalea, the year of the crocus, the year of the ficus, the year of the hot pepper, the year of the impatience, and the year of the sedum.
So now, tell me the reactions you get for this when you make these announcements. Do you hear from people then, or what goes on?
You do. You hear a lot because people go, "Oh, I didn't realize, you know, there was so many different varieties or so many different types I could get of like dogwood." You just think of the dogwood flowering in the tree, and then you forget about all the twigs that you see all winter, and just, it's just fun to see because people, it is a very popular program just because it's so interesting. That, and then we do like tips on, you know, different did you know tips that are always very popular because it's always random did you know things that nobody knew.
Yeah. But, so the Garden Bureau, the National Garden Bureau itself, you talked a little bit about it, but maybe tell us a little bit more about what people will really gain from becoming members.
Okay. We are basically where members are people in the industry, like breeders, mm-hmm. and growers and we do have a ambassador group for people who are just the general gardeners could join, and then they would get a they'd get packets of AAS winners and just be part of helping support bringing out information about National Garden Bureau. That's why we have a whole new plant section that is the most, so these for 2025, we have all the plants that the breeders and the growers and the wholesalers are putting out that gardeners can look at and go, wow, this is brand new for this year. And then they should be able to find it at their garden retailer or online. Just different seeds, different plants, different garden products.
And so how can you join the National Garden Bureau?
There's a, on the website, there's a become a member up on the top. So you could become a member and be a part of it and help bring gardening out to more people. That's our goal is to get everyone to be a gardener.
What is it? What's the cost?
For associates or supporters is, is $100.
Okay, but you're going to get a lot for the money.
Yes.
Well, I tell you what, the article itself and the photos, yeah, that we were talking about with those AI generated were absolutely amazing, and an article like that is really pretty fascinating reading and part of the collection of things that you get when you become a member. Gail, it's been a pleasure talking with you today.
Nice talking with you.
I really appreciate it and look forward to visiting with you again down the road. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Gail Pabst. Yeah, Gail Pabst is our guest today. Gail is the horticulturist and marketing director at the National Garden Bureau and All American Selection. So it was great to have her on the show. And coming up, We are going to be taking a look at iris plants. Do you have some iris plants? Would you like to grow them? We'll talk with our next guest, Brock Vojtilevich is a master gardener and will be our guest next here on WPR News and Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk, and we are going to turn our attention to irises. They look wonderful in the garden, and they're fairly easy to grow. And we'll be talking about their care with our next guest. Brock Vojtilevich is a master gardener and membership officer of the Madison Area Iris Society. So it's great to have Brock with us today. And I hope you'll join in. Maybe you're an iris lover. Maybe you have a favorite cultivar. Maybe you're having some questions relating to their care. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Brock Vojtilevich, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry. It's an honor to be here.
You love irises. What drew you to them?
I do. I don't know, their beauty, I guess. I think I also have it in my DNA. My grandparents were avid gardeners. My parents enjoy gardening as well. But I did have some irisarians in the family, so I think it's really in my blood.
So the Madison Iris Society sale starts today. First, maybe talk about the Madison Iris Society and what it's about.
So that is our organization for irisarians and... actually, even beginning gardeners, our mission is to connect any iris enthusiast. So we're a nonprofit that's based in Madison, but our membership has expanded quite a bit. So we have members across the state, you know, including myself. I'm coming from Stevens Point. We even have members in Minnesota. So, and the club started back in 1981 at Olbrich Gardens following a presentation about growing irises, and seven of those attendees decided to get together and form a club. And since then, we've had a relationship with Olbrich Botanical Garden. We have our meetings there. We also have our annual iris show, which is typically the first Sunday of June. We had a little bit early this year, Memorial Day weekend, because a number of us from the club were out in Montana for the American Iris Society National Convention.
So the Madison Iris Society sale, though, starts actually today. And tell us about the sale.
Okay, sure. Yes, we started at 9 a.m. today, and we're going until 5. We will have the same hours tomorrow as well, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And we're really excited to offer nearly 200 cultivars of irises.
Ooh.
Yes, so quite a selection and a number of different kinds. So not only the tall bearded irises, which are so popular.
Yeah.
We have dwarfs as well, intermediates, and then others like beardless irises.
So lots, and people obviously can come and purchase those bulbs.
Yes, and they're reasonably priced, and all the plants are locally grown. I think that's a big advantage of the sale. So if you're buying at this sale, you know that the plants do well in Wisconsin. They've been grown by our club members.
And go ahead.
And you can also talk to them. They're volunteers at the sale. So if you have questions, they're there to answer.
And I'm sure there are photos of the iris, the plants themselves when they're at their peak.
Yes, exactly. So we have the rhizomes in baskets, and each one has a photo of the blooms.
And what would be a range of prices on those bulbs?
So they start out at $4 and go to $7. So the most expensive rhizomes are only $7, which I think is quite a bargain. You could look at the garden centers or online and find the same varieties. They would be double, if not more.
Okay, so it's a really good deal. And the event is at...
The event is at the West Madison Agricultural Research Station out on Mineral Point Road, 8520 Mineral Point Road.
So, and a good place to go, and obviously it's a good deal.
Yes.
For anybody who wants to try. And for those who aren't familiar with irises, tell us about how they grow.
Well, they're fairly easy to grow. They don't, we could even say they thrive on neglect compared to some other perennials. I would say they're low maintenance perennials. They don't require a lot of water. In fact, too much water would likely lead to rotting of the rhizomes. So now for people purchasing irises, this is a good time to be planting them, actually, because you want at least 6 weeks before the first frost to allow the plant to establish a healthy root system and overwinter.
Which makes this sale a perfect time for a sale.
Exactly. And that's why we do the sale now.
Yeah, it makes good sense. Brock, we have a call from Kim in River Falls. Let's go there. Kim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I dug up a bunch of iris this spring, and we put them in the ground in a different place, and the rabbits have eaten them down to the dirt. I didn't think rabbits ate iris.
Well, typically they don't, but, I mean, occasionally they just, their tastes change, and they try new things, but, you know, irises are not immune to the critters. I do use a fair amount of liquid fence at home to keep deer away, but they don't really seem to bother my my irises.
Would the liquid fence have? Would they have an impact on rabbits?
They say they do, but I don't think anything deters bunnies.
Other than a fence.
Right. Right.
Other than a fence, Kim, I'm not sure what else could be done at this point. And sort of getting rid of them is, an impossible task. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I do live trapping and relocate them.
Yeah.
So,
but then you'll just find more.
Right.
Later on.
There are always more.
Kim, thank you. Mary in Wausau, we'll go to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I have a question about what is probably iris borer. I have a garden that I tend, but I don't get to visit often, and I was just back there, and a nice old-fashioned clump of, like, bearded iris, the purple ones that smell like grapes, they're pretty much dead. There's maybe two rhizomes that look okay, but the rhizomes themselves are, like, kind of mushy, and I had a go-around with iris borer many, many years ago, and I'm thinking that's probably what I got. And then do I have to just dig those out and, like, get rid of them? Or can I wait and see if some of them come back next year? Or what would you advise I do?
Mm-hmm. So great questions. The iris borer is probably the worst pest that you can have for irises. I'm very fortunate. I have not had to deal with iris borer in my garden, but I know that it is... a formidable threat, and many of my gardening friends in Wisconsin are dealing with it. So it sounds like you have some soft rot in the iris rhizomes, and it could be just that, which is bacterial, but it could be that combined with the iris borer too. You know, I'm wondering if you have seen any evidence of, like, small larvae, or if you, later on in the season, there'll be larger caterpillar-like, almost a pink color large larva in the rhizome itself. So in that case, you would want to certainly do some treatment. There are certain possibilities, three broad categories of treatments. So, you know, as a master gardener, we promote integrated pest management, and chemical treatment is the last resort. So I do have friends who just keep a close eye on their rhizomes, and they can see the tiny larvae that emerge, sometime in May, like toward the second half of May probably, and they just squish them by hand. And sometimes if they have even entered the leaves, you can feel a bump and smush them inside. So that is, you know, kind of the basic way to do it. There is a completely organic way using nematodes, which are a natural parasite that attack the iris borer, get inside it, and, you know, slowly eat away and kill the larvae. So that is a great treatment option. They're sprayed into the soil. And I have some resources that I can suggest for further details. So then the last resort would be using chemical treatments. And I know that there are a few chemicals that are listed on the UW Extension article for treating iris borer. So that's a great resource to go to. As a master gardener, we always try to promote evidence-based, research-based practices. So I would recommend checking out that article. But again, that would be really a last resort. And I think to answer your question, you don't have to discard the rhizomes. You can also, if it's just soft rot, you can actually dig them out and treat them with bleach, either diluted or full concentration. That's often done. And cut away the parts that seem soft and mushy and save anything that's firm. So it's possible to salvage those rhizomes.
You just dip them in the bleach, or what do you?
You can spray them.
Dip
them as well.
Mm-hmm. It's soft rot.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to recommend a great resource from the American Iris Society. There are quite a few free webinars that the society has put together, and they can be found on YouTube. And webinar number 11 deals with iris pests, including the pernicious iris borer. So you can get a lot more information about the different treatment options.
Thank you very much, Mary, for calling. Appreciate your call. What's the stage? What is the life stage of the iris borer? Mm-hmm, Let's just go through that.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So in the late summer, end of August, beginning of September, there's a moth that lays eggs. And then those eggs winter over in plant debris, especially the dried up brown mm-hmm. plant debris. So that's another good reason to get rid of that, clean that all up in the fall. Whereas I don't cut down a lot of other perennials, but I would suggest trimming down irises for that reason. We don't want to winter over any eggs. And then, so if they stick around and they overwinter, they hatch in May. These tiny larvae emerge. They kind of start nibbling on the edges of the leaves, the foliage, and they work their way, they bore into the foliage, the leaves, and then you'll start to see damage inside, and they work their way all the way down to the rhizome where they kind of make a home. And then they move into the soil in summer, and they pupate, and then eventually they'll emerge as moths, as the adult moth.
So if I'm not mistaken, this is a really, if you have iris, this is a really good time to be checking your plants, right? Because the tips of the leaves start turning brown sometimes.
Yeah, June and July, you could see a lot of damage. And there are other things that cause leaves to turn brown, such as leaf spot. That's another common problem with irises, especially bearded irises. But the iris borer will do a lot of damage in June and July, and they can, you know, kill the plant in a short amount of time.
Nancy, by the way, called to recommend using chili powder or hot pepper flakes to keep the rabbits away from the plants. And that makes some sense to me.
I've also tried a product called Plant Skid, but I'm not so sure that it kept the bunnies away. They were still nibbling on my petunias all last summer.
Well, let's go back to the sort of the best time to plant. Now's a really good time to be planting iris. I'm wondering about dividing them. How often should you be dividing iris?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's one of the most common questions I get at the Garden and Green Living Expo. So irises really need to be divided every 3 or 4 years. If not, the rhizomes get crowded and they stop flowering. So I often have people come up to me and say, you know, I had this beautiful patch of irises that bloomed, you know, profusely years ago, and every year they bloomed a bit less, and now they're barely blooming at all. So it's likely that they are too crowded.
So if you've got that situation, and can I now divide them, and will they grow?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this is actually a good time to be dividing irises. Since they're spring blooming, you want to divide in really late summer here so that they do have enough time to get established. So, again, we need to get them planted 6 weeks before frost so they can work on their root system, get established and ready for the winter. Probably once they're planted, only about a third of the plants will flower in the first year. In the second year, we can say the majority, maybe two-thirds. And then by the third year, you should have some nice established clumps that will be flowering very well.
And when you're dividing, I mean, what are you looking at taking and as each division?
Mm-hmm, sure. So the mother rhizome will have a bunch of children.
Okay.
So you want, and you're going to be cutting away and discarding the old parts, you know, the mother, because once the rhizome has bloomed, it's never going to bloom again. So you have to get the new growth. And you can cut off all of the new rhizomes and plant them individually. It's recommended anywhere from 12 to 24 inches apart so that they have enough room to grow and eventually establish clumps.
And I'm trying to remember, but planting is kind of shallow, is it not?
Yes, that's one of the most common mistakes for people growing irises, is to plant them too deep. So we want to have part of the rhizome exposed. So
you want it showing?
Yeah, the top of the rhizome should be showing.
Mm-hmm. So that's... And I know that the temptation is always to want to cover
sure.
everything.
Sure. And it really depends on your soil, too. So where I'm from, we have sandy soil. There you can actually, you could cover slightly.
Okay.
But if you have clay, you really can't. So, but I still recommend, even with sandy soil, I would leave a little bit. Like down in the south, they have to cover their rhizomes because it's too hot. Southern U.S. But so it really depends on your location, your zone, and your soil. But here in Wisconsin, I would still recommend leaving the top exposed.
Talking irises today with Brock Vojtilevich, who is a master gardener and membership officer with the Madison Area Iris Society. There's Iris Society sales going on right now. It started today and will run through the weekend. You can take part in that, but you can also learn some more about irises, or maybe you've got an iris plant you have a question about. I hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking irises today on the show with our guest, Brock Vojtilevich, master gardener or membership officer with the Madison Area Iris Society. Again, if you have a question, give a call, 800-642-1234. 1234. And I may have misinterpreted or misrepresented, I should say, the sale, because the sale is Friday, and Saturday tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yes, 9 a.m. until 5.
And again, it's at the...
It's at the West Madison Agricultural Research Station, 8502 Mineral Point Road.
Yeah, with plenty of parking, and it's a great place to be. Gretchen in Stevens Point has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi. I just started listening, so I hope you haven't discussed this already, but my irises this year were all dark purple, and I used to have a nice variety of peach, and I put some white ones in. The white ones actually did grow, but I know I have some light blue, and I had other colors, but the whole lot was dark purple.
All right. Well, what happened there, Brock?
Well, so we didn't cover that earlier, but I kind of anticipated this question because it comes up quite often, so you're not alone. There are cultivars or varieties that are more vigorous than others. So it's I think you said your purple ones are now dominating. So they will actually take over if they're really good growers and even crowd out or push out some of those that are not so vigorous. So over time. And not every variety is going to bloom for you in every year. So you may see a peach one this year and, you know, a different color the next year. But if they're slowly getting more and more purple, I think that's a really good grower and it's crowding out the other varieties.
Oh, so it's growing from the host plant is just spreading out, is
sure,
what you're saying.
Sure. Some people think that irises will change color because, you know, suddenly they have the majority are one color, but that is not the case because the genetics are right in the plant. They are not going to change colors.
Okay. It's just that they're getting crowded out, Gretchen, those other colors. But, as you say, they may... So what would you do if, in Gretchen's case, would this be a dividing time then? Or?
Yeah, I think so. That's what I would suggest. If you don't want that many purple ones, I would take some of those out and give some more space to some of the other colors.
Yeah. Gretchen, thank you for calling. Diane in Ontario, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi, thank you. I have what I think are called Japanese iris, and they grow very well. They have very dark purple blooms, and usually, I think, in June. There's a lot of foliage that's pretty right now, but it, of course, freezes and gets terrible looking. I'm wondering when I can cut that foliage back. Do I need to wait until spring, or I don't want to cut away next year's blossom, which I have done in the past.
Okay,
so that's a great question. So anytime the foliage turns brown and gets dried, I would recommend trimming it to keep the plant healthy. And again, this applies not only to Japanese iris, but really any of the other types, especially the bearded ones, which are susceptible to borer and other pests. So I would discard any of the brown, spotty, or dried up foliage. And I would also recommend either burning it or just getting rid of it so that you're not spreading any pest, spores or any eggs or bacteria, you know, throughout the garden. So don't be afraid to trim any of the brown foliage. You're not going to jeopardize the bloom for next year.
But the green foliage, you want to keep that.
Yes, you do, because the plants continue to photosynthesize. So they need to, you know, produce more energy and store up that energy for next year. So, but I also grow some Japanese irises, and they are quite lovely. So I can see why you're fond of them.
Diane, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And let's go to Barb in Madison. Hi, Barb.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, you were talking about dividing irises, and we have a patch of iris maybe 4 foot by 3 foot, and we've never done anything to them. We haven't cut them back, we haven't divided them, and every year they just bloom prolifically, and they get more beautiful every year. So we're wondering, should I start dividing, or
and how long have,
just leave them alone?
How long has the bed been in?
Oh, I'd say about 20 years.
Okay, so that kind of goes against the advice that I just gave, but some of the older varieties, some of the historic irises, are just such great performers. They will flower profusely year after year. They don't require much maintenance. It seems like some of the more, the fancier, the newer introductions require more care, more division, more maintenance. So, if it's not broken, don't fix it. But if someday they just stop flowering, then I would divide.
Yeah, so you don't have to do it yet, Barb. the old style, sometimes the old ones can be the best ones, huh?
Yeah. There are some lovely historic varieties. In fact, there is a section of the American Iris Society that's devoted to historic iris preservation. So there are a lot of people who really care about this topic. And another resource that I wanted to recommend, besides the American Iris Society, which can be found at irises.org, is the Iris Wiki, where you can find information on thousands of varieties, including some of these historics. So it's wiki.irises.org. Completely free, run by the American Iris Society, a wealth of information.
Oh, that's great. And of course, people are going to see a lot at this sale. I mean, how many types of irises are going to be at the sale?
So we are offering nearly 200 cultivars, so quite a variety. And we have some of the dwarfs that bloom really early in the season. People often ask, or they often comment, I just love irises. They're so beautiful. I just wish they lasted longer. So my advice would be to include a variety of types or classes of irises in your garden so that you can extend the bloom time. If you start with the dwarfs that are blooming at the same time as your spring bulbs, like daffodils and tulips, then you can move on to intermediate or medians. We have border bearded are next. So they bloom sequentially. The tall bearded are the last bearded ones to bloom. And then we have Siberians, followed by Japanese. There are Spuria and Louisiana irises as well. I don't grow those, but you can really extend the iris season to about 2 months, really.
That's wonderful. I have some daylilies. I have some giants that get to be 7-8 feet tall. Are there any irises that will, well, maybe not that tall, but...
Maybe not quite that tall, but there are some really tall bearded irises, 44 inches.
Ooh, that's stalks. Pretty good.
But then they need staking, too, if it's rainy or windy. Can I mention one more thing? Another way to extend the season is to also include reblooming iris. So there are quite a few cultivars now that will rebloom in our zone, or southern Wisconsin zone 5 or 6, further up north zone 4 even, or and 3, I believe. So you can have irises blooming again in September and October.
And on that happy note, Brock, thank you so much for being with us today. We'll do it again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Enjoyed talking with you. Brock Voitalevich is the Master Gardener and Membership Officer for the Madison Area Iris Society. The sale, the Iris Society sale, on today and tomorrow. So don't miss it. Big thanks to everybody. Our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnott. Our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.